Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, we'll hear about the deadly bomb and gun assault in Kabul. There's excitement in New York over presidential election primaries there. A new study on how the richest Americans give to charity. And there's a movie about the tumultuous life of iconic trumpeter Miles Davis.
Miles did make a secret recording that was went missing. He was shot in a drive-by.
It's right here on The Voice of America. A group of Taliban insurgents staged a bomb and gun attack in the Afghan capital, Kabul, today. Reporter Ayaz Ghul joins us on the line from our South Asia Bureau in Islamabad. Welcome, Ayaz.
My pleasure.
What do we know so far about what happened?
Well, the latest details that the Interior Ministry in Kabul has just issued are that a Taliban suicide bomber driving a minibus packed with hundreds of kilograms of explosives hit a main entrance of the building, which basically houses security personnel mostly associated with the Afghan intelligence agency. And this massive explosion caused a lot of damage to the building, but it was so huge that it was heard across the Kabul city, according to witnesses. Most of the injuries that occurred were basically because of this massive explosion, because it's a busy place in Kabul, in the middle of the city, where, you know, it's difficult for the Afghan security to block the roads, because roads passing through this area actually lead to all parts of the city. So that is why it has caused a lot of casualties outside the building, because there were so many civilians either going to the offices, to their offices, or to work. But inside the building, after the explosion, there were at least two Taliban attackers who had explosives strapped to their bodies and were heavily armed. They entered the complex and they opened indiscriminate fire at people inside this building. A training was being conducted for Afghan security forces at the time of the attack, and that's where the Taliban attacker actually rushed to that particular area and opened fire. The latest details are that at least 30 people, including women and children, are among the dead, and more than 300 people have been wounded, according to health ministry officials in Kabul.
What has the Afghan president had to say about the raid?
He was quick to issue a statement this morning immediately after the attack to condemn it, and in the strongest terms, according to him. But he suggested that because the Taliban is suffering defeats in the battlefield elsewhere in Afghanistan, so they have resorted to this kind of a terrorist attack. So obviously there's widespread condemnation in Afghanistan from all sides, civil society, Afghan politicians, and other groups who are condemning it, because it apparently is one of the worst bombing in Kabul.
Thank you very much, Ayaz, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The United States is boosting its military presence by about 200 additional troops in Iraq as security forces battle to retake the northern city of Mosul, controlled for the past 2 years by Islamic State fighters. The announcement came in a statement in Baghdad by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter.
We are going to place additional advisors with the Iraqi security forces now down to brigade and battalion headquarters. We're going to make available attack helicopters in support of the ISF's ongoing efforts to envelop and then retake Mosul. We're going to provide financial assistance to the Peshmerga to bolster what has been, namely the Peshmerga, one of the most effective fighting forces against ISIL.
The announcement boosts the U.S. military presence in Iraq to above 4,000, the highest number since U.S. forces left the country in 2011. On the CBS television network, President Obama said it reflects the growing ability of Iraqi forces to confront the IS group.
As we see the Iraqis willing to fight and gaining ground, let's make sure that we're providing them more support. We're not doing the fighting ourselves, but when we provide training, when we provide special forces who are backing them up, when we are gaining intelligence, working with the coalitions that we have, what we've seen is that we can continually tighten the noose. My expectation is that by the end of the year, we will have created the conditions whereby Mosul will eventually fall.
Mr. Obama's spokesman Josh Earnest was asked if the slow buildup of American forces in Iraq reflects the kind of mission creep that occurred in Vietnam 50 years ago.
This is a classic case of the president asking his team to develop ways to intensify those elements of our strategy that have shown some progress. And we know that Iraqi forces fighting ISIL on the ground in Iraq have benefited tremendously from the advice and assistance that they've received from U.S. service members that have accompanied them. And what we have sought to do is to develop a strategy that would allow us to offer more advice and to offer greater assistance that does not, however, put American service members automatically on the front lines. I'm not seeking to downplay the significant risk that our service members are taking in Iraq. We've already seen a couple of U.S. service members killed in Iraq. What they're doing is quite dangerous.
He insisted their mission is quite different from the one President George W. Bush launched with 100,000 troops in 2003. Earnest said U.S. strategy remains that the fight has to be led by local forces. I'm joined here in the studio with our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, and we're going to have some more on this story a little later in our program. But the big thing today on Twitter is the U.S. contest in New York, and Andrew's been following it, and everybody's talking about it, Andrew.
Everybody's talking about it. Hashtag primary day is one of the top trending hashtags worldwide right now. Election 2016, hashtag election 2016, also trending on Facebook as people in New York go to the polls. I'm from New York, so I have a lot of friends on my social media from there. So you see a lot of kind of jockeying back and forth on who they're going to support, who they should support if people are already in the camp of one candidate or another. But you're seeing a lot of, you know, the last minute campaigning going on. And it's exciting for people in New York because New York is usually in the presidential elections, usually goes for the Democrats. The New York primary, by the time that rolls around, usually everything's kind of sewn up with the nominees. So this is very exciting for people. They say we can actually vote and have a difference and make a difference.
Well, it's also interesting because Hillary Clinton, the Democrat, is the former New York senator. And Donald Trump, the very wealthy fellow, he's a longtime New Yorker, too.
Exactly. And even Bernie Sanders, although he's a senator from Vermont, he was born in Brooklyn, New York. So they all have New York connections. In fact, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton earlier today were voting in New York. Both of them are registered to vote in New York. So we saw those clips appearing on social media. We also saw Donald Trump had a bit of a gaffe in Buffalo, New York, where he referred to, instead of, he was talking about September 11th.
You're telling me Donald Trump said something a little scandalous?
He made a bit of a mistake, and it's caused a little bit of a scandal. He was talking about September 11th terrorist attacks, and he said 7-Eleven instead of 9-11. 7-Eleven, of course, is a chain of convenience stores here in the U.S. So a lot of people pointing that out and saying, on the eve of the New York primary, he gets that wrong, getting a lot of ridicule for that, but people acknowledging that he's still going to probably walk away with this. He's got well over 50% of the vote in the polls, and he's looking for a big win tonight.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew. I know this is going to be a big story the rest of the day, maybe tomorrow as well.
Absolutely. I have no doubt we'll be talking about it tomorrow.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
New research suggests radioactive bits of a star that exploded in a nearby supernova showered the Earth and Moon eons ago. The stellar evidence was found in concentrations of an isotope of iron called 60Fe. Researchers say the star that produced the telltale isotopes was about 300 light years away from us, a relatively close distance, when it exploded about 2 million years ago. To make their findings, the researchers analyzed lunar samples gathered by several of the Apollo missions from the 1960s and 1970s. They also gathered sediment and crust from the bottom of the Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Oceans. The team found that the stars that produced the 60Fe isotopes would have been close enough to Earth to be seen during the day when they exploded, shining with a brightness comparable to the moon. Fortunately, no humans in our modern form as Homo sapiens would have been around to see the event. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's an important day in the race for the White House with the primaries in New York. It's not a winner-takes-all state, so all the candidates may end up winning delegates. VOA's Tina Trin is visiting polling stations around town and joins us on the line from New York City. Welcome, Tina.
Hi.
Say, are you seeing a lot of folks coming to the polling stations to cast their ballots?
Yeah, it's been a really exciting morning. Lots of energy that you can feel in the air, for sure. I think for a lot of people, this is a really important election, even more important than the general election. And you see it in the voter turnout. It's been a busy morning. A lot of people stopping by on their way to work. A lot of folks making sure that they turn up and get the vote out.
Why do they feel it's so important?
I think because right now, especially in the Democratic primary race, you see that margin between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders really narrowing. A lot of polls have Hillary Clinton winning here. And at the same time, you on the ground, you actually see so many more people, so many more folks showing up and turning up for these rallies that Bernie Sanders has had in the last week at Washington Square Park last Wednesday, for example. They reported 27,000 people estimated on the ground in Washington Square Park. And at a more recent rally over the weekend, the number was closer to 28,000. And so the turnout, physical turnout for Bernie Sanders and the support and enthusiasm, you definitely see on the ground, less so for Hillary Clinton, but you don't know, and we won't know until later tonight when the results come out.
That's a lot of folks for the underdog in the Democratic camp.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's largely been predicted that Donald Trump will do pretty well in New York on the Republican side, but what about the mix with the other two candidates, Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich?
Yeah, you know, Cruz is definitely the top contender under Donald Trump. I think at this point it's anybody's game when it comes to Kasich and Cruz. But you have a lot of momentum under Trump that is going to be hard to overcome. So I think there's less surprise there in terms of the Republican race, who is going to be coming out on top. All signs point to Trump at this point.
If he wins New York, if he wins overwhelmingly in New York, will he win the nomination for when they go to the conference, or is there still a possibility that it will be a disputed conference?
Wow. Well, you know, that remains to be seen. There's definitely we all know he's a very polarizing figure, Mr. Trump, and a lot of folks who are working hard right now to make sure that he does not win. It'll be interesting to see. You have a lot of popular votes for Donald Trump at this point, and you know the Republicans are still kind of divided. I think he's a very divisive person, so even among their ranks, he's not winning a lot of support there. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
I've heard that the polls there in New York City don't close till 9 o'clock, and some people are grumbling they're going to have to stay up late tonight and watch TV to see who wins.
Well, you know, here in New York, everybody works really hard, and so it's work hard, play hard, and we need to keep them open for everybody who is, you know, having to get out of work late, whether that be their last shift at the restaurant or, you know, mom picking her kids up after school. The schedules are all around the clock. It's the city that never sleeps, so we need at least until 9 p.m.
Okay, well, have fun out there at the polls and on the streets, and thanks a lot for talking with us today, Tina.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, a look at rich folks' philanthropy and a dark film about a famous trumpeter. The Chronicle of Philanthropy, after analyzing 2013 Internal Revenue figures, the most recent available, found the 400 U.S. taxpayers with the highest incomes had given an average of more than $32 million each to charity. Joining us on the line from the organization is Dan Parks. He's managing editor. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me on.
What did the study find?
We found that that the wealthy, the people, and by wealthy we define that as wage earners. This is IRS data on wage earners. So this wouldn't include people who have billions of dollars but who may not be making a lot of money. These folks gave away an average of more than, as you pointed out, more than $32 million each to charity in 2013. That figure is actually down a bit from 2012 when they gave away nearly $40 million each.
So I was going to say, how does that compare to previous years?
It hit a peak of $32 million in 2007, I should say another peak perhaps, and then it fell after that. Right around the recession, it fell to $24 million on average per among the wealthiest 400, down all the way to $17 million in 2009, and then it shot back up in 2012 and then declined a little bit in 2013. So obviously this moves with economic cycles and how wealthy the wealthy are feeling. The last 2 years have been pretty good overall for giving, and that's probably a reflection of improvement in the economy.
And how do you find all this information? Can anybody go look at the IRS records?
The IRS does make this publicly available. Sometimes it's a little hard to decipher, so that's what we do, is we try to pull out the most interesting statistics and present them in a easier-to-look-at way. The one thing I should point out is they do not tell us who these 400 taxpayers are. That is, of course, confidential information. Nobody can find out how much you made or how much you gave away on your tax return, according to your tax returns, and we don't know that either.
Well, I'm not one of these 400 taxpayers, I'll tell you that much.
Neither am I.
So how can you use this information?
It helps address issues that oftentimes come up about whether the wealthy are doing enough. Now, if somebody's making $500 million, is giving away $32 or $33 or $34 million a lot? I don't know, but the trend has been up over time. And one other statistic that we found that was quite interesting is that the amount of charitable giving that these top 400 wage earners are responsible for has been going up over time. So in the most recent years available, these top 400 wage earners have been responsible for between 6% and 7% of all charitable giving among people who itemize their tax returns. That is way up over 20 years ago when it was down around 1.5%. So, in other words, the wealthy are responsible, the wealthiest people in America are responsible for an increasingly larger share of charitable giving.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
One of the best ways to help the environment may be to simply use what you already have. And that includes food. About a third of the world's food goes to waste, according to the UN Environment Program. But an organization in Israel is trying to change that by collecting fruits and vegetables not attractive enough to sell.
What we're doing is helping to utilize them, and instead of throwing them, to give them to people that need them.
Oren Hershkovitz volunteers with the organization Leket, which distributes food to the poor throughout Israel. Katie Crotch is the CEO of Leket and wants the government to set standards in the food industry to cut waste. In the meantime,
we can rescue about 8 billion shekels worth of food.
Crotch says he wants Israel to adopt the UN goal of reducing food waste by 50% within the next 15 years. That would put more food on the table for those who need it and keep less of it out of the landfills. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
Actor Don Cheadle is making his directorial debut with his film drama Miles Ahead, which looks at the tumultuous life of iconic trumpeter Miles Davis. Cheadle focuses on the musician's visceral talent, inner demons, and sense of humor in a film noir type of thriller, complete with car chases, shootouts, and drug addiction. VOA's Penelope Palou has the story.
If you gonna tell a story, come with some attitude, man.
Attitude is at the core of this Miles Davis biopic.
I want it to be gangster. I want it to be wild. I want it to be impressionistic.
Miles Davis. My name's Dave Braden, Rolling Stone magazine.
I'm here to do your comeback story.
Okay, move back a little bit.
Yeah.
The film portrays Davis in the late 1970s during his fallow period, a recluse with physical ailments and a cocaine addiction.
It's based on a lot of incidents, you know, like any biopic. There, you know, characters are composites and their amalgams. A lot of that stuff happened, you know. Miles did make a secret recording that was, went missing. He was shot in a drive-by. He had many reporters coming to him during this period of time trying to get the story.
This is madness. I am not dying over this jazz tape.
Don't call it jazz, man. That's a made-up word. It's social music.
Through flashbacks, the film juxtaposes an older, paranoid Davis with his younger, confident, though arrogant self, at the top of his game. We learn of his emotional dependence on his then-wife, talented dancer, Frances Taylor, and his abusive behavior towards her, both physically and emotionally.
I need you.
Tittle does not sugarcoat Davis's transgressions. He loves the music icon for who he was and portrays him as a soft-spoken yet intense character. Ewan McGregor, who interprets the reporter shadowing Davis, grounds the fraying icon to present-day reality. Tittle calls his teaming with Ewan McGregor a great artistic experience, but also a necessary pairing with a white star so he could get his film off the ground.
I would have more difficulty financing it unless the actor that I picked had an international appeal. And having Ewan McGregor and sell to the UK was a huge piece of the pie that we needed in order to get the ball rolling.
On the heels of the Oscars' so-wide controversy, Tittle neither defends nor chastises the industry. A pragmatist and a celebrity himself, he sees Hollywood as a big business, averse to risk and fear-based.
You're black?
That does not mean he defends its typecasting stereotypes. Hollywood, he says, does not take purposeful aim against blacks and other minorities, but its decisions, he says, can lead to racism and bias all the same. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
If you would like to know more about our program and listen to it again, visit our website at voanews.com. To listen, go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner. Scroll down to International Edition. And thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at a seminar in Botswana's Ganzi district in early April, U.S. Ambassador to Botswana Earl Miller called Botswana a laudable example for other countries to follow. Now, Botswana could be among the first countries to actually control the HIV epidemic. The seminar was organized by an interagency team from the U.S. government in partnership with the District Multisectoral AIDS Committee. The U.S. also partnered with the Media Institute of Southern Africa. This program was sponsored by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which is the country's global health initiative to assist countries in responding effectively and sustainably to the HIV epidemic. Over the last decade, PEPFAR has committed more than $780 million to Botswana in its response to HIV. Together with the government of Botswana, civil society, and other development partners, we have come a long way, Ambassador Miller noted. Ambassador Miller lauded Botswana's progress toward meeting UNAIDS Global 90-90-90 targets, referring to the HIV testing, treatment, and viral suppression targets. 90% of those infected with HIV should be aware of their status, 90% of those aware of their status should have received treatment, and for 90% of those being treated, the drugs will have had the intended effect of suppressing the patient's viral load. A study sponsored by PEPFAR found that out of the 3,500 individuals from 30 communities who tested HIV positive, 83% of them knew their HIV status. Among people who knew their HIV status, 87% of them had initiated treatment, and 96% of those on the treatment had achieved viral suppression. This was only a relatively small sample size in just 30 communities, but it is encouraging. Ambassador Miller commended the government of Botswana for considering the adoption of the test and treat policy. Moving towards earlier initiation of treatment is strongly supported by a recent international randomized clinical trial, he said. Treatment also acts as prevention by lowering the risk of transmission to uninfected sexual partners. Now is the time to redouble our efforts and together run to and through the finish line.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.